This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 31st of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 269 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On this edition of the Weekly, what in this terrifying world still scares us? Author Joanna Briscoe will be here to give us a lesson on how to write a modern ghost story.
Then John Moore, formerly of the Jesus and Mary Chain and Black Box Recorder, will join us to talk rock and roll in the 80s, 90s, noughties and today. And he's got a new record out, of course.
And later in the programme, we'll be joined by Helen Thorpe, who's followed three women to war.
All that and, of course, some great new music too, and Tom Edwards' news look ahead coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. You know that thing where they, I think it's called the Marathon du Sable, where they run like nine consecutive marathons through the Sahara Desert? That's how, about how I feel this week, Andrew Tuck. How do you feel? How many marathons do you feel you've run this week?
You look like you've got mental blisters.
I woke up really early this morning. I think that's always, I get a bit stressed out during production week.
I know, you're quite a delicate thing. People don't realise it.
I am a delicate thing. I wake up typing in my sleep. At least that's what it sounds like. Let's not do that.
No, let's move on. So there's been a frantic week. So we had the book launch, the Monocle Guide Good Business, in all good bookshops now, buy your copy. And we did that here in London on Tuesday. And then we did a big event at Selfridges on Thursday to launch the book as well. We're almost packing our bags for next week. So if you're a subscriber and you're going to be in Berlin, Antwerp or Paris, we're going to be in your cities and you should come along to the book launch. Buy a copy. And we also finished the October issue, a beast of an issue.
Yeah.
And you've got new sections and all sorts of things.
All sort of jazzed it up. It's sexy, it's new, it's sparkly. But it does make me feel like, and this isn't just because I've been doing a lot of book signing, I maybe need to put some new lead in my pencil.
You maybe do.
Have you got an ink cartridge spare, Andrew?
I might be able to help you out. And
that's right.
What else? What else happened? And the other good thing that happened is we've talked about him before, but we'll talk about him again. There's a gentleman who sits on our desk, and he's a new member of staff.
Yeah.
He's learning his ways, and he'd been on a trip. He had a pink suitcase that he'd borrowed apparently from his grandmother. Tom Reynolds. We love Tom Reynolds, but he was trying to sneak out the office.
A wheelie suitcase, sort of like almost practically under his arm. He's dodging between cars, wasn't he?
He was trying to get it under some camo, I think, to kind of get it out of the office.
Yeah.
But anyway, we spotted it.
But thanks to your frank meanness and the...
It was very nice of Granny Reynolds to lend it to him, but I don't know if he'll be using it again. That's all I'm saying.
Do you think it passes Monocle muster, bright pink?
No.
A cerise valise?
No. As our editor-in-chief said, you should tie a ribbon around that so you can spot it on the carousel.
I thought that was quite a good one. That's a keeper. I might use that one myself.
Not that it wasn't glowing like radioactive material, but anyway.
Do you think we can ask any of our guests on today's show that question? You want to tie a ribbon around that so you can find it on the carousel?
Let's see who that can... Well, we can ask our first guest that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, here he is. We can see him peering through the glass with a sheaf of newspapers under his arm. It's Tom Edwards with his news look ahead.
Baby. Who knew the news could be so hot? Delivering a look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards. Baby.
I forgot about that jingle. Hi, Tom.
Pretty impressive jingle right there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who's doing the baby?
I don't know. It sounds like Yellow.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It's a bit of.
I don't know if it's appropriated. I'm sure it isn't.
The race.
Copyright reasons.
Yeah. And what's going to happen next week, Tom?
I've got a few for you. We've got some sports. We've got stamps. We've got sex. We've got sheepdogs. We've got summits.
Let's hope none of those topics combine. But anyway,
some of them do.
Okay,
do they? Put them all in the juicer, mix them up.
Let's start with sport and religion.
Okay,
the papal match for peace takes place in the Vatican tomorrow. Good old Pope.
Football.
Pope Francis. He's getting a bit of a game together. It's an interreligious match. Current and past players representing different cultures and religions. So we've got Buddhism, Christians, both different sorts of them. Jews, Hindus, Muslims, some Shinto practitioners, not quite sure where they'll fit in, you know, on the wing or whatever. And they'll all play together.
They're on different teams, they're all on the same team, it'll be a medley of teams to show that, you know,
so
they can all,
together.
The ball to each other, so it's not like the Muslims versus the Shinto.
No, it would all kick off, as it were, literally, metaphorically. Okay. If that happened. But you've got some big names, Rob, you know, Javier Zanetti's going to be there, Zinedine Zidane.
Oh, right.
Gianluigi Buffon, Francesco Totti.
Are they all actually of different those different religions?
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Are they
I think
just wearing
they're there for the star value.
Okay.
I don't know whether Pope Francis is going to sort of get involved.
He's going to blow the whistle.
Because Pope John Paul, he was quite a keen player. I think he was a goalie, wasn't he? As memory serves.
Yeah. It's difficult that you can trip in your hassock.
Cassock.
Okay. What's a hassock? It's a hill, isn't it?
The hassocks. It's an area of countryside, isn't it? The hassocks.
Well, this was a different story. I was explaining when you go to the countryside, you can trip on the hassocks.
You can. I want to be quite good in
the trossocks are a part of Scotland.
In goal with a. With, what's the big
hat? Cossacks. Like you can trip like over them because they're always putting
mitre.
Their legs out.
Oh, dear. But with a mitre, you could be good at heading.
That'd be amazing. Yeah.
You might spear the ball, though.
I hadn't thought of that. I've not thought this through.
I like the
papal soccer. I think that's fun.
That's great. That's really good. Is this televised? Is this on Vatican TV?
I'm not sure. I know that Vatican Radio has been announcing, you know, some of the news surrounding it. We sometimes chat with our friends over there, so maybe we'll check in with them and see what's occurring.
I think that'd be great.
See who wins. Get the football results read out. Where should we go next? Sheepdogs, World Sheepdog Trials, Wednesday. That is taking place
Wales?
At Fern Farm near Tain. I think it's in Scotland. Is that
Tain? T-H-A-N-E.
Have I displayed my?
No, that's minutes. Good.
240 dogs. Now, Andrew, I know you're a dog owner. Imagine that. Now they're very well trained, admittedly, but imagine them all getting together,
chatting.
It'll
away.
It'll be worse than an interdenominational football match. so that's all quite exciting.
They could be in the match with their little noses pushing the balls
never
around
get the ball
the...
back, would you?
I love the. I think when they took one man and his dog off BBC TV in the mid 1990s, so they've had
this
more
was
complaints,
sheepdog trials,
more complaints, yeah, than any other pro or con program on the
well,
in
to,
BBC TV.
I had to
history.
Make my feelings known.
And it was always really upsetting when they found the dogs guilty at the end, wasn't it?
That is quality. What a great program that would be.
Put on the
black hat. So let's race through. So what's some serious news? On Thursday...
That was serious.
Big NATO summit. But it's happening in Wales, of all
places.
This is
one in Wales with a sort of £50 million exactly. security price tag.
Quite. So they've had to shut airspace and all this sort of caper. So we'll dispatch...
They've
had to shut Wales for a few days. We'll dispatch one of our in-house Welshmen to go and cover this event.
Okay.
So there'll be more on that on Monitor 24 later in the week. Obviously, all the big issues of the day for NATO to deal with. Petro Poroshenko, Ukrainian president, he'll be in town as well.
Well, maybe it depends what's happening back home, I think.
He's got one or two issues to settle. So he's going to be a bit busy with that. This is a fun one. You know, I said stamps.
Yeah.
And I also said sex. And I said they sort of came together. So this is... I think we talked about this before. This is
I know. I literally had to stop myself there.
Well, exactly. So, but these Tom of Finland stamps in Finland. Have you seen about this?
These are sort of the gay, muscular,
we talked about, exactly. Extraordinary things by Tom of Finland. He's best known as Tom of Finland, but it's Tuukko Laaksonen, who is the artist, who's divided his time between Finland and the West Coast in the US. And a lot of these extraordinary drawings are going to feature on stamps. It's been very controversial in Finland when the news was announced. We talked to some
people.
They're
going to be in Finland, these stamps.
And they're actually out on September, so you'll be able to, you know, lick the images, as it were.
Lick the back of Tom of Finland.
Exactly. And send it on its way.
Hold on, I restrained myself. You two didn't stop, did you?
I was simply describing actual news.
Okay.
And what about one last something a bit foolish to close? This is quite fun.
Unlike,
you know, because that's been deeply serious so far.
Yeah.
I like a sort of novelty race. You mentioned Marathon du Sable. We've done the sort of wine marathons where you go vineyard to vineyard. This is sort of related. It's the Montepulciano cask race.
Oh, I love this.
Have you ever heard
of this?
One of
my favourite wines.
Exactly.
My favorite regions.
So you go into Tuscany, to Montepulciano.
Yes.
And the race of the casks, the Bravio della Botte, if I've said that correctly. Teams of two, you get a cask each, one of these huge...
Bags are not in the cask.
Barrels. No. Both of you on the outside of it. Maybe there's someone inside.
Rolling
I don't
it.
Know. And you've got to race through the streets rolling these things.
Wow. That's
can you imagine that?
That's
and
a
imagine
recipe
some
for
refreshments
that's
options
a
as well.
Recipe for a broken toe, but I wouldn't mind a broken toe.
Well, that, and you'd have to sort of...
Brunello afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah. What fun. So, yeah. Multiple
Watch
car,
out. Don't hit the Shinto
race.
Priest.
And it'll be happening
you'll be running
a little
across
later
the road.
Today. You'll be able to hear those barrels rolling all
what's,
the way across
what's
Europe.
What's the barrel rolling again in Italian?
The race of the cask is the Bravio della Botte.
That means the man with the smallest bum. Tom, thank you very much indeed for your news. Do you have another thing? I can tell you had another thing at your sleeve.
No, I haven't. That's literally all I've got.
Oh.
You have to wait till next week. Who knows? I might even not even be back then.
Well, we hope you are. Mysterious. Thank you very much.
Pleasure
thank
as always, you. Andrew.
Now, moving house isn't easy at the best of times, but a new novella takes it to a whole new level. Touch tells the story of a woman, Rowena, and her family, who moved to a rather drab cottage in the English countryside. The ceilings are sagging and the wallpaper's stained, and soon Rowena's life also starts to crumble. Then, one by one, her daughters go missing.
The author of Touched is Joanna Briscoe, who was born in London but raised in the West Country, where she first started to write. She's since come back to the capital, but those early years have clearly left a mark on her fiction. Joanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Know, you've written quite a few books over a long time span, 20-odd years. They all seem to have had a slightly different feeling. But is this a new departure for you, the idea of doing a ghost story? Because I see you talk at the end of the book about the idea that, in fact, all of your characters have been slightly haunted yes. in some way or other since the beginning.
Well, I thought it was a departure, but actually I now realise it's not. It's a continuation of what I do anyway. It's slightly different, and I love the challenge of that, but I would stand by it as one of my normal novels, as in it's literary, supernatural. But the ghosts are, you know, they're pretty subtle. And it's about psychological haunting as well. And actually, it made me think about my fiction in general. And I did realise that all my novels are haunted one way or another, usually psychologically, about, you know, they're haunted with the past or guilt or neurosis. So I love doing this because there was a requirement that there was something supernatural about it. But actually, you know, it just fitted right into the way I think anyway, in that slightly dark, gothic way.
I like that. Does writing a genre novel as such, does that kind of set you free as a writer? Because, you know, there are sort of points you have to hit. It gives you a bit of a plan. It's almost like a bit of commissioned writing when you've got the structure of a genre to fit into.
Yes. Well, there's a mixed answer to that, as in it was genre
yes
to
and no.
Yes and no. It was genre to an extent, as in it had to have a supernatural element. But the clever thing about those Hammer novellas is that they ask these literary authors, so Jeanette Winson, Helen Dunmore, and then we're allowed to do whatever we want within that. The only requirement is there is some paranormal supernatural element or twist at the end. So if I were writing purely genre, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't accept that commission. On the other hand, the requirement that it was shorter than a normal novel, so it's between 40,000 and 50,000 words instead of, say, 80, did mean that there was something delightful and deadline-y about it. And in that way, it did feel like a commission. I had a short deadline.
Yeah.
And I knew what I was aiming towards. And I also got good notes from my editor in that she said, don't make it too complex. Don't have a big subplot going on. I normally mix time and several plot strands and the structure's a bit of a nightmare. Whereas this was more straightforward in that way. There's still quite a lot packed in for 44,000 words, actually.
Joanna's saying it's exceptionally good value for money and is probably available at all good bookshops.
Absolutely. How did you guess?
And it begins in, well, it takes place in 1963. Not the time that we think of as ghost story territory. What was it about 1963 that seemed like an ideal place to have your supernatural experience?
Well, it's not the time we think of, and it wasn't the place we think of or the weather we think of, and I wanted all that on purpose. I didn't want to, you know, Victorian, gloomy. I thought it would be interesting to write about the 60s before the swinging 60s really took off. I wanted the dregs of the 50s. There was a slight Mad Men influence in that, you know, early Mad Men, we think we're watching the 1950s when we're not. And I loved that aesthetic. So that was definitely an influence. And then this little village in Hertfordshire, very close to London, I just thought, you know, those tight-knit communities, very suburban, it would suit that time.
And as you're revealing, but that fictional place has a connection with a real place for you.
Yes. I was born in London, then my parents moved out, and I lived there till I was four. And it's about 20 miles from central London. I hadn't seen it again until a couple of years ago. and went back, and it was creepily exactly as I'd remembered. So I just couldn't understand how my memory had been so good at that age, much better than it is now. And I also thought, ooh, if I'm writing this immediately, that is the setting. It's too picture perfect.
Now, there are more. I interviewed Peter Ackroyd once about his book, collected book of English ghost stories. And the first fact that came out of that there are more ghost stories in the English language than any other language. And what I should say is actually there are more English ghost stories about set in England than anywhere else, which is an amazing sort of thing.
Yeah.
You've got, there's a bit of a mountain to climb, but is it nice to be, is it sort of, do you feel kind of warm in the bosom of the English ghost story?
Well, the funny thing is I had barely read a ghost story. I'd read
okay.
I have now. Since writing it, I've got fascinated by them. I'd read The Turn of the Screw and Sarah Waters' modern ghost
story. No Susan Hill in there, because that's sort of like the...
Susan Hill, I had read one, but not a ghost story.
Right.
I since read The Woman in Black, but not at the time. I mean, amazingly, I really hadn't. I'd read some gothic fiction, but then I stumbled across Roald Dahl's collection of ghost stories. It's an anthology. It's not his writing. He edits it, and that's very good. And that led me to some of those authors. So I've now become a fan, and actually I'm watching a lot more horror as well.
Cheer up of an evening.
Yeah. And I wondered, where, I mean, the fact that, you know, that you went back to the village where you bought, you know, you went back there for the first time since you were 4 years old, nothing had changed, is even a subconscious influence in a novel about the supernatural. Does that make it extra tough to sleep at night when you're putting one of these things together? When you're writing it, you've accidentally put a little bit of autobiography in there, perhaps, subconsciously even. Then you kind of go...
I'll tell you, the way it kept me awake at night was actually writing the
deadline.
Yes, the deadline kept me awake. Okay. I didn't have time to be haunted myself.
I'm surprised the novelist hasn't written a horror novel about the deadline.
Yes, that's the horror.
Okay.
It was also the inspiration. I loved having a deadline, just I hated it. I know what you're saying, and there were little autobiographical twists there because of the setting. But in a funny way, I'm so removed from it, so very far from age four, that it gave me freedom as well.
Now, just to tell me also, the countryside to me always, you know, again, what's interesting, you set it in the heat of summer and our character regularly wakes up, Heron wakes up at night, you know, hot, sweating, there's fantasies going through her mind, all sorts of things revealing themselves to her. But the countryside is a strange place. And you've lived in town and in countryside. You know, I'm somebody actually who's very much a city person. And, you know, if someone asks me to put the rubbish out when I'm in the countryside and it's dark, I'm petrified, kind of put it in the bin very
quickly.
We had
a test on field and hedgerow birds, Andrew. And yeah,
I know my birds, okay. but I would literally, I would put the rubbish in the bin. I'd be back in that house in like one second.
Yeah.
Do you find, and houses as well, and the idea of lives lived in them before and all this stuff. Do you think that the countryside has something that is inherently good for a ghost story? That, you know, the mud, the darkness, the lives lived in these old buildings.
I think absolutely the isolation means that anything could happen. And most of us do get somewhat scared when we're in an old house and when we know that there aren't people around us, because what if there was something real or supernatural on the attack? Who's there to save us? Yeah, I don't mind being alone in my house in London at all, but even I, and I'm used to the country, there just is something creepier about being in the country, particularly in older houses. And of course, you were saying about all these ghost stories in the English language. You know, England's such an old country. There are so many old houses. We have so much dreadful weather. I think it does, even though I chose to have this bright sunshine in a slightly perverse way, I think, you know, the land is made for the ghost story.
And tell us about the imprint as well. Writing a novel for Hammer is an interesting thing, because what does that brand name do to you as a writer? Do you always have to include Peter Cushing in there? I mean, I wonder whether the sort of camp excesses of some of the horror stuff that we think of, that's our shorthand of Hammer, it's tempting to squeeze them in.
Not really, because even though it has the Hammer label, it's not really about that, you know.
Yeah.
It was very clear what was wanted. And although I think there is, actually, despite the odd kind of slightly camp, slightly surreal aspect to this novel, which I did on purpose, I'd only watched a few Hammer films as a child and enjoyed them or been terrified by them. But, you know, it was a Hammer Random House production Yeah, I was working with an editor at Random House, so it didn't
feel... So the sequel will not be called The House That Dripped Blood.
I don't think so, though. It has influenced the way I'm thinking about the novel that I'm writing now, as in there won't be ghosts around. But in the same way as in Touched, to an extent, there's a kind of creepiness and a darkness and a suspense that I want to mine, because it's something that I'm realising I do and that actually I enjoy.
Can I ask you about when I looked back at the publishing dates for all of your books back to 1994, you're not somebody who's churning out books. You're not kind of somebody, your fans are not going to find, you know, a new Gianna Briscoe novel every single year. They're going to have to pace themselves a little bit with you. And do you know when you start a book how long it's going to take you, or what the gestation period is? Or is it just wrapped up with the fact that you have a private life and a world going on off the page that makes sometimes, you know, the book wait a little bit?
Okay, are you calling me slow here?
No, I think you are. Literary.
No, you're tapping into my guilt about this. A couple of times I've just taken a long time, and then, as you say, you know, I've got a life, I've got children, and so I've made my life my priority. And I have been slow, but there've been very different gaps. I mean, this one, actually, it's 3 years. My previous novel, You, was 3 years ago, so that's not so bad.
It's not bad. I just wondered.
No, that I know.
I'm just intrigued.
It's like working guilty. On the magazine.
This is an issue. This is an issue for me, as in I should be a bit faster. And in fact, I'm going a bit faster now. But no, there have been some big gaps. I think I write quite complicated novels that need a lot of work, and I'm very keen to get the prose exactly right. So, you know, I'll do literally 20 drafts.
And before we let you escape, the world of TV has obviously embraced your work as well. Do you imagine that this, would you like this ghost story to become television? Do you enjoy that process of seeing your words, you know, be used by someone else for something quite different?
Well, my experience with Sleep With Me was fantastic because, you know, it was Andrew Davies. I mean, you can't get better. And I was thrilled with that. This one I actually do see as the most cinematic of all. Whether it would be film or television, I don't know. But, you know, that's up to other people. And certainly it's something that I would love. I saw it in this very visual way when I was writing it. But I don't think you can write intentionally for that, because then it doesn't work. You know, the psychological aspect doesn't work. But it is a very visual novel. And in fact, I've been asked to do some screenwriting. I'm not sure that would be my ability. I think I need to carry on being a novelist.
Brilliant. Well, Joanna, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That's Joanna Briscoe, who is the author of Touched, which is out now.
Do you have a piece of new music, Andrew?
Yes, please.
This is something I think this comes out in September. When I was at the Green Man Festival last weekend.
In your wellies.
Yeah, a buddy of the show said to us, he was playing this on Green Man Radio, a man called Pete Feed. He's been in here a couple of times. We've done the Christmas shows with him. And he's mates with Martin Carr. Do you remember the Boo Radleys from the 1990s?
I do.
This is new from Martin Carr. It's a beautiful song from a great new album. The single from it is called The Santa Fe Sky. Why don't you check this out? And that was The Santa Fe Skyway, new from Martin Carr, and the record The Breaks comes out in September.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong. And two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Our next guest is a man of many virtues. After playing with the Jesus and Mary Chain and enjoying the hazy days of late 80s New York, musician John Moore, found himself in London, penniless and brokenhearted.
With a little help from red wine, absinthe and a four-track recorder, John penned some new tracks. Fast forward 2 decades and they've just been released on his new record, Lo-Fi Lullabies. And John joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
We should point out that this record comes out tomorrow, doesn't it? Lo-Fi Lullabies.
It does, yes.
That's a gestation period akin to a blue whale, John, in terms of a record coming out. Tell us about the making of Lo-Fi Lullabies. And what does one sound like?
Well, one sounds a bit like... There was a time when I could have stood up to you, argued my case without caving in. That kind of stuff.
It sounds pretty lovely. I've listened to the record. We were sent a link. I think you sent us a link.
Yes,
listened
I did.
To a bit of that on SoundCloud.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful LP. We'll maybe talk a bit what it sounds like. Every musician's nightmare. Do the music crit bit. But first of all, yeah, I interrupted you in the middle of what was going to be an amazing answer at the beginning. Why so long and where did it come from?
Well, when I got back from America after my abortive rock star period, came back to Earth with you know, hell of a bump, really. So I was back in my flat in Paddington, on the dole, broke, but still writing a lot of songs and actually beginning to write proper songs, I think, is... That's more the case. And so I would record them into my little four track. And, you know, I still had this sort of optimism that anytime soon major record labels would be knocking down my door to sign me again with these dirges. And it never happened. And, you know, I kept playing and I kept writing and I kept recording. And but then other things happened. Black Box Recorder happened, and although that band kind of started almost as a one-off, slightly sort of jokey art project, it took up the next 10 years. My involvement with importing absinthe suddenly took off, and so yeah, I had the songs put away for a rainy day and kind of forgot about them until recently realized that there aren't really any record companies anymore. There's really never going to be a big payday. And then I listened to them kind of critically with sort of nice 20-year gap and realized that I quite liked them as they were. And they had a certain atmosphere that, you know, I think is very unique, very strange. I played them to a few people who said, you know, you've got to release these. So I did. Vanity won.
And that's the thing, they've got this amazing, I mean, the record has such a lovely intimate, I mean, you sing close to the mic.
Yeah.
The playing is beautiful on it. I was reminded of some sort of Syd Barrett solo stuff and the Velvet Underground and these kind of very these intimate sounding projects. When after 20 years, can you listen to them as a critic almost, as a man with a great record collection, I'm sure, or do they still feel like you made them yesterday?
Well, the strange thing is they still do feel very fresh. I'm still kind of, you know, I know it sounds maybe kind of slightly big-headed, but I'm quite pleased with them. I'm quite pleased with the lyrics. I mean, I listen to
That's
other...
the smallest big head I've heard from a rock star.
I listen to other stuff that I've written a long time ago, and I cringe quite often. You know, how could you have thought that that rhymed with that? You know, where were you going with that song? You completely did. You know, you completely made a fool of yourself. But with these, I think, you know, that the first period of my career, in a way, was quite useful because it got all that out of the way quite quickly. So when I started again, I'd actually read a few books, actually, you know, I'd had my heart broken a few times, travelled a bit, and so I had something to write about.
And John, the period of 20 years, obviously, you know, that you talk about the fact that these record labels didn't come knocking at the door, but was there also a sense that after being in, you know, a band that everybody knew and that was successful and had a kind of a reputation, that you kind of needed that to kind of die down and change and you be allowed to reinvent yourself a little bit and be, you know, a bit more of a kind of stripped back musician yourself?
Yes, I definitely think so. I mean, it was great. I'd never put down being in the Jesus and Mary Chain, but it wasn't my band. It was something that I was, you know, hitchhiking along in. And so I think when I started doing this was the, you know, what I should have been doing anyway. So to have a taste of, you know, the sort of pop high life was very nice. But, you know, the pop low life
is what follows.
That's really where it's at.
Does it help you? I mean, being in a big band and doing all that touring and all the rest of it, does that help you be on your own and write songs? Or is it awful? Do you get kind of claustrophobic after the huge open spaces that you toured before?
No, I'd like the claustrophobia. Yeah. I like being in a room. I'm not very, although I'm quite a friendly person, I'm not very good in crowds, which is, you know, perfect for my music because I'll never be one. So, yeah, the sort of insular sitting, drinking wine, looking out of the window, watching the rain, that's kind of where the inspiration comes from. I mean, it was nice. You know, Black Box Recorder was another taste of success. So, you know, one comes along, or did used to come along every sort of 10 or 15 years. It's a bit late this time.
But that was that. So, I mean, that was obviously a very sort of literate, lyrical. I mean, it had this, you know, Black Box Recorder, Luke Haynes, it had that sort of very rhythmical quality to it, of course, as well. That was kind of a very different thing to the Mary Jane.
It was completely different. It was closer to what Luke was doing and to what I was doing. We were people that wrote a lot of words, read books. I know it sounds awful.
Steady on, John.
Just comics mainly. But I think he'd kind of reached the point with the auteurs where, you know, there wasn't so much happening. And so when you stop caring and just everything's a bit tongue-in-cheek, everything's a bit of a game, we never expected that to work. And you know, it worked perfectly. We actually sort of wrote a song. You know, what do all the hits sound like on the radio? Right, yeah. We'll write one like that. And, you know, next minute we're on Top of the Pops.
The KLF moment.
Very much like a KLF moment.
We should probably get you to introduce another one.
Yeah, we should have another. Let's have a bit
songs.
Let's have a bit more of a song. Should we have that? Should we have the... Yeah, let's have...
Oh, okay, I should do a...
Picture his face, he was so out of place in your life. You're glad that he's gone. It was good while it lasted. You never expected it to carry on. But who's gonna tell you the dress that you're wearing tonight looks divine? And who'll zip it up at the back and bask in your light as you shine?
That one in its entirety is called Now That Your Lover Has Gone, and it's available tomorrow.
I absolutely adore that. Yeah. That's maybe it's rather moving.
Do you think you have to have a... You said at the very beginning of our interview that, you know, you had your heart broken a few times, you know, and it's obviously come good in some senses, but do you think that for the music you want to write, actually some of the tougher times have actually been important to it?
Absolutely. I mean, at the time that these awful life events are happening, you don't really see it that way because you're just trying to endure them. But if you can kind of, you know, sort of reach into yourself and, you know, there's this kind of wry smile to be gleaned from, you know, the chaos and the heartache because you know there's some good poetry there.
Yeah, right. It's the payoff, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And does the kit, as you said, recording this in your flat in Paddington and doing it on small time equipment.
It's very small time.
Could you do it in Studio 2 at Abbey Road? I mean,
no,
it would have the same vibe, wouldn't it?
You couldn't. And I always thought that when I played these things to people, that, you know, that would be the first place they'd put me with the London Philharmonic Orchestra to really, you know, and then at the Palladium. But no, I mean, it was a little 4-track cassette recorder, and you know, there wasn't very much you could do. No overdubbing really, or just very, very little overdubbing. And so you filled up the tracks, recorded as loud as possible, so the tape's kind of saturated. And it's just a cassette, and it took me 20 years to realize that was how it should be sounding. So, you couldn't fake that sound. You couldn't recreate that sound. And there's no algorithm to make that sound. There's no plug-in on computers to get that. It really is just, you know, what it is.
You're right. It's got that. One of the ways that it's an intimate record is that tape is saturated. There is so much detail on it. It feels like, you know, it's great. It's an amazing thing to listen to on headphones, actually, as well. Although we do recommend people go out and see you and make that room as claustrophobic as possible. One final question. I don't think we can really get away from this. Mm-hmm. Does absinthe make the heart go fonder?
it certainly does. Yep, but I haven't touched any for a little while. Can't even have aniseed toothpaste now because that gives me a hangover.
John Moore, thank you so much for coming in. The record is called Lo-Fi Lullabies. It's out tomorrow. People will Google it and they will find it. That presumably is the thing.
There's a companion record with it as well called Floral Tributes.
Okay.
It's a blue one and a red one.
Oh, I like that. Depending upon which side of the debate you're on, presumably. Yeah. Maybe you can play us out with something else that's emblematic of the record.
Okay, well, I'll play you one from Floral Tributes.
Time, gentlemen, please. Finish up your drinks and go celebrate another dark night of the soul. Paradise is coming soon. The final lock-in at the Last Chance Saloon.
And if you want to hear more, you'll have to buy it or go online or something.
John Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service, based in the heart of London with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries. We broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Women have been involved in the US military since 1775, doing tasks such as cooking, washing and mending clothes. But it was not until 1948 that the law was passed that made women a permanent part of the military services. Today, women serve in 95% of all army occupations and make up about 15.7% of the active army.
Our last guest, author Helen Thorpe, spent 4 years interviewing female soldiers, researching their stories, aspirations and battle experiences. Her book, Soldier Girls, shines a whole new light on why women join the army, some of them never even thinking of being deployed to the front lines pre-9/11. Helen joins us now from Denver. Helen, we should pick up that point first of all, that the three characters who make up your book, Michelle, Debbie and Desma, they all had very varied reasons for signing up. And some of them certainly didn't think they would ever be on a front line, did they?
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, the branch of the military that they joined is called the National Guard. They were in the Army National Guard. So they ultimately did deploy as part of the United States Army, but they were in a branch where really they thought of themselves as part-time soldiers. In the National Guard, you typically have a civilian job and then you drill with the National Guard just 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks in the summer. But after 9/11, some National Guard units were sent overseas on full-time deployments. And then they had to sort of interrupt their civilian lives and put on the uniform every day instead of just 1 weekend a month. And it was a very, very different reality than what they had been anticipating.
Helen, I'd love to know, in terms of the book, in terms of putting it together, first of all, it'd be great to know how you found your subjects. From, as we said, there are, you know, there are 95% of all parts of the army, there are women working in it. Did you have to correspond with quite a few to find the perfect subjects?
You know, I began interviewing different veterans from all different branches of the military, men and women, who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was especially interested in what were the challenges in terms of coming back home and resuming lives at home as civilians. And so the National Guard, because they're not in the military on a full-time basis all of the time, was the branch of the military I started to focus on. And then when I met the young woman, Michelle Fisher, she just leapt out at me because she was such a great storyteller. She speaks with very vivid detail. She tells stories with all of the color that, as a writer, you might want to have. And when she introduced me to her friends, Desma and Debbie, Debbie had kept 6 diaries. And Desma, who returned with some injuries from her second deployment, was happy to share very early on in the process all of her medical records, even her therapy notes. And so they gave me so much material to work with. That's how I ended up focusing on their lives.
I wanted to touch on that. What's interesting is, you know, when you're writing a contemporary biography of somebody, you wonder what the sources will be in these days when people don't, you know, write so many traditional letters. And these people gave you access to their email, to their Facebook, to all sorts of sources that we don't normally think of. How rich a vein and how important a vein was that for you?
Well, it was critical because since I met these women actually in 2010 and we were trying to reconstruct the previous decade, those sorts of sources were critical because I could hear the women speaking in their own voices. I mean, it might be written speech in a letter or in a Facebook post, but you would hear just exactly how they were speaking in real time to somebody they loved or somebody who was important to them. And I think it really captured the flavor of their personality. And otherwise, I think the book might have felt dry or difficult, but they're so lively in the way that they communicate with, you know, a boyfriend at home, or in Desma's case, with her 3 children at home, in Debbie's case, with her partner, who she goes on to marry about halfway through the book. You know, their personalities really, really come to life in that material.
I mean, I'd love to know as well, kind of how you see this might fit into the canon of war writing and sort of military writing. Are girls a lot more confessional than men, or do they know what's coming at them in the field of conflict and can kind of deal with it a little bit better? There's no posturing, it seems, in your book, Helen.
Well, one of the issues I faced in writing about women is sometimes women are placed in dangerous and difficult situations doing missions that are similar to men. But generally speaking, over the last decade, many women serving in the military were in what are called support positions. And that was true for these 3 women during their first deployment. So 2 of the women were working as weapons mechanics, and 1 was working in the motor pool, tracking the maintenance on vehicles. So they were helping to support infantry soldiers who were all men, the infantry soldiers were leaving the post and doing missions that were considered more dangerous. And these women were meant to be in safer, relatively speaking, safer jobs, supporting them. And so I think one of the reasons that women's work in the military hasn't been written about as much is that you might think of that as not very dramatic. I mean, if they're not doing these big, dangerous, dramatic missions, will anybody want to read the book, you might ask. And I did actually ask my editor that question. I mean, are their lives dramatic enough in that canon of like military history to be worth a book? Then we sort of ended up discussing that, but in the second deployment to Iraq, you actually see the nature of their work change as women are being deployed into jobs that are considered more dangerous. So Desma, who was trained to work on military software, tracking maintenance on vehicles and other equipment, she had a desk job essentially during the Afghanistan deployment. But when she was sent to Iraq, she was asked to drive a gun truck at the front of a supply convoy out on the highways of Iraq. And her job was to help look for roadside bombs. So as a single mother with 3 children, by 2008, which is when she's in Iraq being asked to do this work, I think the military no longer had qualms about asking a single mother to do that sort of thing, whereas previously that was unheard of. And so they did live through a very historic shift in how the military was thinking of deploying women. And I thought that was fascinating.
And I just wonder, and I hope you take this question the right way, but I think the book successfully sort of breaks down these sort of the traditional gender castes mm-hmm. in terms of the military. But would you rather that more men read this book than women in that sense?
Well, I would love for the book to have equal numbers of men and women reading it. I think it's possible, because the three main characters are women, that more women might read the book. I wish more men would read it, in the sense that I think it could be enlightening, especially for men in the military, or who, you know, men who make decisions about where the military might be sent next. You know, I think it would be enlightening for them to have a deeper understanding of the experiences of women. And the book is so full of detail that I think it does bring these women's lives really into sharper focus, and you can really sort of walk miles and miles in their shoes. And that, I think, would be valuable. But I won't be surprised, I have to confess, if in the end I have more women readers, because I think they will identify with the three main characters as women who are trying to juggle work and family, relationships and professional success. So it may be more appealing to a female audience in the long run, but men will find it terribly enlightening if they do read it.
Helen, I wanted to ask you, obviously this is a story about three women, but what's been interesting is over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, me and Rob, we've met some very interesting authors, filmmakers who have tried to address what's happened in Iraq, and photographers too, and what's happened in Afghanistan. And there's that sense of, especially I think for Americans, coming to terms with what these wars have meant and what the legacy is. And also trying to balance the acceptance that, you know, that people did tough, important jobs, but a nagging sense that was it important enough for the losses and the sacrifices that were made along the way.
Yeah.
Do you feel that your book, you know, without being grandiose, is trying to answer some of that nagging doubt in Americans' minds about what these wars were for and what we ask people to do for us?
Absolutely. I think in American society, there has been a terrific gulf between civilians and those people who serve in the military. In previous conflicts like Vietnam, we famously had a draft, and then everybody was participating emotionally in the question of whether deployments should happen, because there were so many more people at risk of military service that was not voluntary. This time around, with what military leaders like to call an all-volunteer army, you saw a big separation take place between civilian society, where people thought, well, I'm not going to have to serve because I haven't volunteered, so I'm not really going to worry too much about these wars. I'm just going to trust that they're going along as they're supposed to. And then everybody else who was serving and was, you know, always trying to evaluate the worth of the deployments, how the wars were going. And I think the book is trying to address that division in American society and help people understand the human cost of these deployments. I think many people in American society did have that nagging sense that you're talking about, of wondering if these wars were worthwhile or what were we accomplishing exactly, especially now as we start to see chaos in some of the places where American leaders were talking about trying to build viable democracies. And everybody is, I think, trying to reevaluate, were all those sacrifices worthwhile? And I'm trying to show, what was the human cost for these three individuals? What did it cost these three women? How many times did they end up losing a relationship at home or starting a relationship during a deployment and having it not survive the transition back home? So yes, I think trying to evaluate that sense of, were the sacrifices worth it?
Well, Helen, thank you so much for your time. We could speak all day. We don't have time to speak all day. But thank you so much for joining us on the line from Denver. That was Helen Thorpe, author of Soldier Girls.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
By the way, I'd just like to point out to all our listeners that we don't have a script for the show, do we, Andrew? Offset. Where we come to the end of another lovely show.
I always forget when you have a musician in the studio with you, and when they start singing that close to you, there's something really strange. These people who could, as you say, kind of be in a stadium, or they could be in a, you know, a big venue. What a great guy that was.
So, he was cool, wasn't he? Yeah. John Moore was excellent. He actually, I think that's that kind of having lived quite a hard life and being in a big band and done all the things that go with that. And then you come out the other side and you write these very personal, beautiful, kind of bluesy songs. He really reminded me of Nick Lowe. It's got that thing, that kind of bruised valour about him. And Helen Thorpe, we just heard from, she was great as well, for all sorts of different reasons. But that's quite an amazing book, isn't it, Soldier Girls? It's quite an unusual thing. It's kind of letters from the front, but in a completely different kind of social media conscious way, but not in a self-conscious way.
And again, I always think it's interesting when, I think it's quite an American thing, actually, when you know a huge amount about a topic and you're very comfortable with it. You feel no need to kind of use any hyperbole. You're just kind of really calm about a difficult subject. And she was just like so eloquent. So unlike me, eloquent. That was, again, a really wonderful interview for us.
I loved everything. And Joanna, your old mucker from The Independent, she was great.
We crossed paths at the Independent.
All the people that were in The Independent have gone to wonderful things. None greater than Andrew Tuck. When's my review coming up?
Not long now, Rob. Not long now.
Yeah. And we should thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Isabel Kayser, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll be here. I think it's going to be us again next week.
Yes, we're here back next week.
Back next week, same time, same place. But for now, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in. Yeah.